Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm happy now to welcome Meryl Lederman Euclides. She is an artist. She will be giving a lecture tonight, the 10th of May, at 6 o'clock at Tipton Hall on the campus of the College of Santa Fe, sponsored by the Santa Fe Art Institute. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi.
It's
very nice to talk to you.
Yeah, it's wonderful to have you. I'm just getting to know your work. I heard about it years ago when you were, and I guess still are, working with the New York City Sanitation Department. You are, among many other things, an artist in residence there. How did you get started working with them? Tell us that story.
I had been making art about different ways to think about maintenance, about support systems that enable life to continue for many years. And I did a piece at the Whitney Museum. They had a branch in Lower Manhattan in a very large building that was several million square feet called 55 Water Street. And I was invited to be in a show there, and I made a performance work and that was also an installation work in the museum. But I did the performance work with all 300 maintenance workers that keep this skyscraper going, operating. And it was called I Make Maintenance Art 1 Hour Every Day. I invited all the maintenance workers. I wrote a letter to each worker, and I invited them to consider 1 hour of their regular work art, however they define that. I never defined that for them. And I said I would come around the building during all the work shifts over the 7 weeks of the exhibition and ask them if I could photograph them while they were doing their work. And then I would ask them, I shot them with a Polaroid. They don't exist anymore, I don't think. But it's the Polaroid that where a photograph comes out of the camera.
Right.
And I showed them the image of what I had just shot, which was them doing their regular work. And I asked each person, showing them this image, what am I seeing? Are you making maintenance work or are you making maintenance art? And I had labels printed, pre-printed, that would fit this peculiar one-inch blank space at the bottom of the Polaroids of those days. And whatever the person said to me, I'm making art or I'm making work, I accepted, and I put the label at the bottom of the image. So that when the exhibition opened up, my area in the exhibition, which was quite large, was gridded off with three-quarters of the space was against a dark blue color because most of the maintenance work is done at night when the regular people go home. And then about a third was during the day. And when the show opened, and I had buttons made also for the workers, if they chose to, that said, I make maintenance art 1 hour every day. And as a sign that they were participating in this artwork. When the exhibition began, my area in the museum was blank, except for this proportionality, which was expressed about when the work was done, and it had a title, I Make Maintenance Art 1 hour Every Day. And what happened was I sort of inhabited the building. I kind of moved into the building, and I went around with this camera, always asking people's permission. I would never shoot them without their permission. And little by little, I would accumulate these images and mount them little by little in the museum. And by the end of the exhibition, there were 720 images. And what they were evidence of choices, free choices, that the workers had made of how to identify themselves. I am making art, however they interpreted that, or I am making work. And I had phenomenal experiences during that time. First of all, some workers are very great workers. They do their work almost especially people who handle very great weights, you know, moving big bags of waste around. Some are really clumsy, and some are stars. And just about everybody knows who the stars are. There was one guy in particular named Bruno, who was just breathtaking. He could move great weights as if they were nothing, because he understood how to position his body in relation to the weight, and stacked up great, filled up huge elevators with these bags of waste, as if they, and he was skinny as a rail. And there was one time, and this building is so big that it was like a block long, the hallways, and the elevator door opened up, and there was Bruno. I got to know him because he was so terrific. He was all the way at the end of this hallway. It was really very far away. And I approached, and he saw me coming, and he said, "This is not art. This is not art. This is work." And the door shut.
Right.
Or there were people that, I was shocked at how many people wore these buttons. They really did. The bosses said, "I don't think anyone will participate." But it wasn't true at all. People were very, very eager to tell me stories about what it's like, because there was this sort of a series of rules. For example, if you're a porter and you're cleaning the floor, it's a very, very fancy building. You're not allowed to, if someone makes a deprecatory remark about you, you're not allowed to answer them. That was the deal of the building. You had to work with wearing a tie and a shirt buttoned down, as if I learned so much. Like, I kept what's the idea? What's going on? The idea is that there's a kind of Apollonian order in this very this building. Held the Central Depository Trust, which is, as I understood it, much of the money in the city was stashed away in like seven floors that below grade at overnight, and it was the headquarters of Chemical Bank, I think, and most of the building was filled up with businesses dealing with a lot of money, so that there was a kind of quiet in the public areas, and the image that was projected was that it is automatically clean and ordered and totally under control, so that a man, one of the workers who was participating in this work, came over to me and said, "Do you know what just happened?" I said, "What?" He said, "Someone just spit on the floor that I just washed."
Wow.
So I said to him, see, he could tell me, because I became an entity where you could tell something like that. I said, "Did you say anything to him?" He said, "We're not allowed to say anything." So that they no longer had to be silent. They no longer had to be like part of a machine that keeps this building in stasis. That was their purpose. They were a presence that was silent, constantly working, keeping the building in this harmonious order. And I kind of offered an opportunity to for sort of another layer of, that's not what I'm thinking. I'm thinking something else. You know, I'm looking at this in a different way. Anyhow, the workers started coming to the museum, and the people at the Whitney, this branch of the Whitney, said to me that the maintenance workers never, ever came to the museum, that the idea of the museum in people's eyes who work in the building was that it's for, quote, the workers, like the regular people who have a kind of status, not the people that keep it looking like that. But because the work was about them, and actually they knew much more about it than I did, I mean, they were experts, they started coming into the museum. And a wonderful thing, the Whitney held the closing of the of this exhibition at midnight, so that it was sort of a celebration for these workers, the night workers, so they could, you know, see the conclusion of the piece, which was the wall was completely filled up with these choices of free people who were how they regard what you're seeing. And it ended up looking like the building, you know, this sort of gridded space where you, like windows, you could see people doing this, doing that. There, another thing that I liked so much was that because the workers knew much more than I did, they were very critical audience, which I love. And I think most artists love when people really, really look at your work and pay attention. So, for example, one guy came over to me. He was a cleaner, cleaned bathrooms mostly. That's what he did. And he said to me, "Come here." I said, "What?" He points up to this series of pictures that I had taken of him cleaning the men's bathroom. He said to me, "You know, you didn't get it." I said, "What do you mean?" Because there were several pictures, like a series of his doing this, doing that, doing that. He said, "Come with me." And he took me into the men's bathroom. And he said, "Do you know what you missed? You missed cleaning under the rim of the toilet." You know, like that was the hardest part of his job, because that got really yucky. And you didn't get the flushometer. I loved it. I thought that meant that the piece, it worked. Like it became a real piece. It was a real something, cultural something in the building. Now, another funny thing happened. This is the world of maintenance. So what happens in this world? At night, when the regular people go home, so the cleaning people come into offices, even the offices of the executives. And what do? They clean their offices, like their desk, you know, the file cabinet, the chairs, mostly the weirdest thing is the desk. But the deal there is that they're not supposed to see anything. Now, a person's desk can be kind of private, especially people who are handling lots and lots of money. And you can imagine what can be in there. But the worker is supposed to be there, dusting, cleaning, so when the person comes, like the power person comes back the next morning, everything is orderly as if nothing happens there. And he's ready for another day. So I'm there with them in one of the executive floors taking pictures. I don't care what's on the desk. Just taking pictures. I'm looking at, you know, them emptying the waste baskets, dusting here, dusting there. How carefully are they dusting the tops of the file cabinets and all that? taking my pictures, and all of a sudden I hear these walkie-talkies going off. These are huge floors, huge office building, offices. Where is she? Where's that artist? Where is she? What floor? Where is she? Where is she? Like one walkie-talkie. So they track me down. And they said, where are those pictures? Let's see those pictures. You're going to have to show those pictures to the manager. Why? Because they were, as all of a sudden, the security people got panic-stricken. What am I shooting? Like, maybe I'm taking photographs of their financial whatever.
Right, right. Big secrets.
I couldn't care less. And of course, these maintenance people see this stuff all the time, right? As if that's the deal every single day, but as if they have no vision. They're there, but they can't see it. Anyhow, so I am sent the next day. You have to go see. We're shutting this piece down. You have to go see the manager. So I go see the manager of the whole building, and I show him and I show him the pictures that I had taken the night before. And I don't know what he's looking at, and I sort of don't even care. All I care about is what is the worker doing. And he says to me, look, you cannot show this image. So I have this little red flag goes up in me. Censorship? Am I going to be part of a piece that's completely compromised because of censorship? Am I going to say, I'm out of here, I'm not showing this piece is over and all that? And I look at the image. I said, can I see it? I look at the image. I don't know what I'm looking at. Like some papers on a desk. And I figure, you know what? It's okay. He said, we have to withdraw these pictures. So I put up a notice on the side of the piece, saying that some of the pictures have been withdrawn because the management felt that they showed things that the people who made them are not public. So I felt that was fair. That I was being clear about what the choice. It was really about that art is always about freedom of choice. So as long as I kept that clear out front, you know, on the front plane of the artwork, that it was okay. But visually, it was hysterical. Like, I didn't know what I was looking at.
Right, and nobody else would have either.
No one would have. That's okay. I kind of liked it. Like, it was, they were taking it seriously. As if, oh my God, I could blow away the whatever. I don't even know what it was.
You could bring down the financial system.
Right. Anyhow, there was an article... an art review in the Village Voice, written by a wonderful art critic named David Bourdon, who has passed away. And he wrote a very positive review of my piece. He said, he started it out, workers of the world, unite. Now you can call your maintenance work art. And he described my piece, and at the end, see, this was 1976, which was the height of the terrible fiscal crisis in New York City, in the country at that time. Many people were being laid off. I mean, it was a terrible, I don't know if people remember this, because we've had such a more recent fiscal crisis. New York City was being urged to go bankrupt, to declare bankruptcy, and it really was walking up to the edge of handing over the city government to a judge. It was literally inches away from declaring bankruptcy. Things were so bad. So he finished his article by saying, perhaps the sanitation department, which just got its budget cut because of the fiscal crisis, and his laying off workers, could consider its work performance art and apply for a grant from the National Endowment for the Arts as an artwork and replace its cut budget. So this was sort of tongue-in-cheek. But I looked at this article and I thought, the sanitation department. You know, I thought like 300 maintenance workers from this building was the most any artist could ever work with in a performance work. But I thought, well, you know, I sent a copy of this, just a photocopy of this Village Voice art review to the commissioner of sanitation. I didn't know who that was. I didn't know where I looked it up in the phone book. Where is this commissioner? I didn't know where my garbage went from, you know, I literally didn't know where the waste that I made, what happened to it after I threw it away. But this seemed like such a cool idea. And I get a call very soon after I put this letter in the mail. I get a call. Hello, this is Francis. I'm the assistant to Commissioner Vaccarello. How would you like to make art with 10,000 people? So I said to her, I'll be right over. And that's how it started.
Well, one of the things that is so fascinating to me about this is here you have these people, maintenance workers, garbage men, who are marginalized to the point where they're not even allowed to speak to the people around them.
Well, in fancy buildings, they're not. The sanitation workers speak. They speak.
No, yeah, but in...
Well, they speak in the garage, or they speak, you know, out on the street. They're also not supposed to talk back.
Yeah, and they are marginalized in the sense of doing work which is hard and smelly, and people don't like to think about their garbage, even though they're the ones who make so much of it.
Right.
What, when they were given this opportunity to look at their work as art, what were some of the memorable things that they did that they called art?
Well, first of all, I spent after I went to see the commissioner, who, you know, when you meet a person, very often the first things that they say have a huge influence on you, and you don't even realize it for a long time afterwards. So Commissioner Vaccarello said to me, go talk to the guys. They're great guys. People don't understand that. They're just, he spoke in such a friendly way about the workers that it, you know, I found that very interesting that this, you know, like the big cheese downtown, the big boss, had such a warm feeling for the people that worked there, and it that had a strong influence. I didn't realize it, but it, you know, like someone sort of sets you down a path, and you don't realize, like they're like a guide, and you don't realize it. Anyhow, he had appointed a staff member with the car to drive me all over the city and show me all the facilities and introduce me to many people. And I just simply talked to them, learned about where does the garbage go, you know, how many different places are there, how many garages, how many landfills. There were many at that point. There were incinerators. What is going on here? And I just flipped, because to me it was, I had been focusing on maintenance. I started out on interior maintenance myself as a highly educated person who had a baby and became a maintenance worker and was totally unprepared by all my fancy education for the world that I entered as a mother maintenance worker.
Totally. So for you, motherhood was a kind of maintenance work.
Absolutely. It's the same kind of work. It's repetitive, very necessary, devalued work. Work that people don't want to hear about. They really are not interested in talking to you about it. But it has to get done. Work that is not what the culture thinks of as being interesting or exciting. Not at all. Especially, this was like 1968. So I had learned a lot about the world of maintenance myself and was so shocked that how my education had nothing to do with this, nothing. I was uneducated in becoming a maintenance worker. Anyhow, that was projected on the maintenance workers that I met in the outside world, of all kinds. And for me, the sanitation department, this was like the major league. I was being invited to come into the major leagues of the whole maintenance world. I mean, this was like the big deal in the maintenance world. So I was thrilled. I was just thrilled. And I said to myself, this is a great, great opportunity for me as an artist who's interested in this. And I spent a year and a half talking to people, listening to people, so that I made a set of proposals. What did I want to do with this great opportunity? And the set of proposals included a work ballet, because I got to know how incredibly skilled these workers were in the crazy streets of New York, where you could end up being triple parked and or manipulating a street sweeper. It was nuts because the streets are so dense and kind of crazy and bags of piles of garbage and all that. So I said I want to do a work ballet, tease out the skills of people, clear away the traffic, and let people see how skilled these people are. And I wanted to focus what I called then, this was in 1976 and 77, on urban earthworks. Because I saw these landfills, these huge hundreds of acres of earth right in the city limits. At that point, you had to keep the garbage inside the city limits. That was the law. And I discovered on the perimeter of the city, Queens, Brooklyn, Staten Island, the Bronx, these huge mounds, earth mounds. And you go to the top of the mound and you see the World Trade Center and the Empire State Building from all of them. It's like, because you're on this outer ring of the city looking into the center, these incredible places. And I thought, wow, you know, the classical American earthworks are in, where are they? They're in Arizona, they're in Nevada, they're in some in New Mexico, they're in places that the images of wide open space, sort of empty space, where you can manipulate the earth and kind of do what you want, like the individual artist, like shape it, remake it, like that. But to me, the problem with the earthworks, which I love, is that it's very hard to get there. Like, you have to often know someone, especially in the early 70s. You have to maybe hire a private plane to fly you there. And I thought, you know, there's another way to deal with the earth, thinking about the meaning of the earth, shaping the earth, transforming the earth. Here are these huge chunks of earth right in New York City, and you can go see them on the subway. You know, the whole huge numbers of the public, the access to them is easy for everybody. Everybody can get there, not just the collector, the individual, the person who really knows how to get out to the desert. So I proposed making urban earthworks at the landfills. From the very beginning, I wanted to make a film that I called Future Fruits, where I said, in the future, this was before recycling. This was even before environmental regulations, if you can believe it. It sounds like another age. It was another age. I said, one day, these things we throw out are going to be valuable. And I'm going to make a film where police will escort these objects that have been thrown out because they suddenly have value. And it sounded like a fantasy at the time. You know, like recycling was just the beginning idea. Except, I mean, in World War, when we have war and you realize how resources are scarce, people had gone through time during World War I, World War II, where they things were recycled, but then that all sort of fell away. So I, during this year and a half of learning and talking and mostly listening, I proposed a set of big projects, big artworks that I wanted to do. But then I kept thinking to myself, like, who am I to be opening up my mouth about these things? Who am I? Why should people respond to me? And then I thought, and I also heard so many sanitation workers saying, you know, it's just like you just said, it's not my garbage. Why do people call me names? Why do they call me garbage man? Like I'm part of the garbage. It's their garbage. It's a get me out of here. Like I'm not the garbage. I'm a person. I do this so I can support my family. And I thought, how weird. Like New York is the center of media. It's practically the whole world. You know, the TV stations are right down the block, all over, and here are these workers on the streets every day. So transparent. Why are they not seen? Why are they not seen? Why is their work not seen? When there were articles, they were almost 100% negative. These guys are goof-offs. We should privatize the sanitation department. Sell it. Run it like a business. These people are incompetents. It was this hideous, plus people were getting laid off. So when I arrived, I mean, people who had signed on to be sanitation workers, not because they wanted to do that work, but because very often they came from economic hardship in their childhood. And they wanted to be able to count on having a job, you know, entering the American dream, getting a mortgage, going into debt, get your kids a good education, get a house like that. That they could do. They would trade what they do for getting this steady income. And what happened? A lot of them started getting where they could count on it. It was like stability. And what happened during these very scary days of the fiscal crisis, they started getting laid off. So that there was a layer of hysteria among the people that I met because they were saying to me, I have a mortgage. If I get laid off, what's going to happen? I'm going to lose my house. You know, sounds familiar, right? I'm going to lose my house. What am I going to do? Like people were really terrified. People were so shook up. And so another reason why I came to do this first project that I did was to get a kind of credibility that I could do these other big projects about this kind of work, but also to respond to this terrible sort of trap that I felt these workers were in, the same kind of trap that I personally felt when people would see me and, you know, I was trying to be an artist, trying to be a mother, working. I never worked so hard in my whole life, and people would see me pushing a baby carriage. They wouldn't say to me, what do you do? What is it like to give life to someone? What is it like you're discovering a human being, discovering the world? What is, oh, isn't that interesting? What is it about? Or what is your work like? Like a position of questioning me, asking questions as if I had something to say. Instead, what I had this incredible experience. People that just met me pushing my baby carriage around, they would say, do you do anything?
Right.
That sent me into outer space. And the same inability to see, to literally to see, to ask, to want to know, to want to care enough to know what is the work like, was across the board, across the whole maintenance world of our culture, which did not understand the basis of the culture, the basis. You know, I started to write and say, sanitation is the first cultural system. Without sanitation, you don't have a culture. You can't walk around in the present. First, you have the sanitation department, then you can have a city. So I with all this terrible feeling, and feeling of how stupid this is, actually what a waste this is, to put people in that position. I proposed doing this piece called Touch Sanitation, where I simply, and it's a very primitive work, almost a piece that where you no longer believe in media, where I said I'm going to face every single worker in this whole system, wherever they are. That means going through the whole entire city to shake hands with every person and say thank you for keeping New York City alive, because I felt that beyond any way that you might have to evaluate this or judge them or, you know, think about them, that number one is that everybody's dependent upon them. We are in relationship with them. We need them, and without them, we cannot have a city. And they need to feel that. And I felt the same thing about me. If I'm giving life and supporting life to my child who I love, I'm doing such an important thing. I need people to say, you know, great. Tell us. This is great. What is this world about? So I proposed this work to the sanitation department. I also said I would always work at least an 8-hour day. The performance work would be mirror. The currency is you put your body in there for 8 hours at least. You know, sometimes I would work 16 hours, so I would get the night shift as well. And I literally faced every worker, and it became this ritual. I face to face, you know, not sending a letter, not taking a video of masses of workers out on the street. This was person to person, shake hands, say thank you for keeping New York City alive. And then I would come at roll call. That was at 6 o'clock in the morning or 7 o'clock in the winter, and then I would walk out the routes with the workers. I would walk behind the truck, and I sometimes would choreograph their movements. Like I would copy their movements as if I'm, you know, like imitation is the sincerest form of flattery.
Right.
Like I would copy them as if, because the audience is sort of hidden, like behind the window shade, behind the Venetian blind. You have this, you're taking their material, but you don't really all that often talk to them. And there was this alienation, not always, but really to a big extent, there was a kind of alienation between the people and the sanitation workers who were moving this material out so that the people could come out and be in the present, not be in yesterday. And I thought it would take 3 months, and it took 11 months.
And what was it like for you, for them, and then for, I mean, whatever audience outside found out about this work?
Well, I was lucky. You know, you also have to be lucky. I was lucky to you can imagine this piece had to have many, many layers of approval. This is a big, big, powerful agency in the city. And the person that I worked with the most, the person who taught me where is everybody, you know, how do you get there? How do you find 8,500 workers? They're not all hanging around on one corner. Was a man called whose name is Vito Turso, who is the Deputy Commissioner of Public Affairs. And guess what? He's still there.
Wow.
This was 1977. And he and I cooked up this this process where every day a telex, that's like what there was before faxes and even before the internet. And like, how does the central headquarters communicate with people all over New York City? They move thousands of trucks around and say, you know, this is more important to do, that's more important to do, do this, do that, do this, to people all over the whole city, thousands of people. They do it by telex. They send out a telex. We need this number of trucks here. Move. Today we're going to pick up the snow, so that the system has to be flexible and responsive, totally responsive. So piggybacked on the regular telex that went out to all the sections, the most local office all over New York City, was this art thing, a telex that would say, good morning, touch sanitation will be in District, Queens District 5, Section 4 today. Because I want, at that point, there were many undercover groups who wanted to privatize the Department of Sanitation, who had very negative feelings about the Sanitation Department. They were referred to inside the department as the Rat Squad. Or, I don't know, there were all sorts of names for them. And I didn't want to ever be associated. I'm not, you know, who am I? And when I first started, people were very nervous about me. Like, am I one of these undercover rat squad people trying to find terrible things going on? Who am I? Who is this person? Like, it's not normal to have an artist there for the whole day. Who is this person? What is she about? What does she want? Is she a reporter? Does she work for the unions? Does she work for this? Does she work for that? Little by little, and my piece started off with a press conference with the commissioner, with the heads of the officers' union and the regular sanitation workers' union, two big Teamsters unions, very powerful unions in New York City, and introduced me and wished me well, and we started off this performance artwork with one artist in a garage in Greenwich Village in Manhattan District 1. And the TV cameras came and the newspapers came. So it really started off with a bang. Along the way, people started writing about it. Like, they wouldn't write about the sanitation workers who are there all the time. But because this was kind of a strange thing, a unique thing, what is this? The media started focusing on that. And then what happened was a writer for Newsday wrote an article, and you know, a lot of times people in the media will write kind of, it sounds sort of okay, but really it's very condescending way to talk about art, like it's sort of nutty, weird,
right,
wacky,
right.
And dismissive. Yeah. So he wrote a kind of article like that, and I flipped out, and I wrote him a letter, and I said to him, "You're wrong about this, that. I was very particular. I called out all sorts of things that I felt that he just missed and got wrong. And he wrote me back and he said, "Don't have a fit. I'll come back." And I wrote him back and I said, "Do not come back unless you're prepared to spend 8 hours. And don't talk to me. Talk to the sanitation workers." He said, "Calm down, I'll be there." And he ended up writing another article where that's what he did. He spent the whole day. He talked to the workers. He got some real content about what's the work? What's going on? Plus, these people have fabulous images of the city. They're great experts about the reality of the city from the street. And he wrote a wonderful article at the end. And so that there was a kind of dialogue generated because of the artwork and because it was really kind of simple. I said I was going to do this, and I did it. And I did it all over town. And really, what was I doing? I was modeling. They sign up to do this work. And what do? They show up, and they keep coming back. They keep coming back, and they take away your garbage. Now, there were some days, like I remember we were in a very, very poor neighborhood in the Bronx. And in those days, there were metal garbage cans and the beginning of plastic garbage bags. But some people couldn't afford to buy plastic garbage bags. So they would put the garbage in paper bags. And then I remember this was the week after Thanksgiving. So, and it was raining, like really raining terribly. And we were picking up in this really poor neighborhood. And there was so much food waste, like after a holiday. And the bags broke because it was raining and they just like gave way and the food was like slopped all over the sidewalk and they had to like pick it up and it was pouring and I just started to cry. it was so when something happens at home, like right. Something spills all over the floor that you've worked on and it's just such a mess and maybe you're really tired. And it's like, I just stood there, and I was standing there crying. And the sanitation workers, they stopped, and they just laughed. They laughed at me. They said, "What are you crying about? You know,
right.
We've been doing this for 20, 30 years." They were great. Mostly they couldn't believe that some positive things were being said about them. There was a feeling, people would say to me, "This will never change. People will never see us. They'll never really see who we are. This will never change." And you know what? That's not true. like the biggest thing I learned was that you don't have to accept a stupid bad thing. Like now I would say that there have been many, many, many changes. For example, I had a show at the I spent 4 years preparing a show called Touch Sanitation Show. At the end, I got a grant from the NEA for $3,000, and I spent it penny by penny on audio tape. I had over 100 hours of audio tape just on the street. Like I would hang the recorder on my shoulder and people would talk on the street. And I could afford 7 days of video. I wish I had 100 days of video. And it ended up in a show. And part of the show was the recreation of one of these section offices that was furnished by sanitation workers taking in the furniture off the street. Like the city did not, up until that point, the city didn't provide furniture, special furniture for the sanitation sections. It's hard to believe that. They were didn't have a big enough budget so that they would furnish the section offices with stuff they got off the street. Now, because these people are expert material handlers, they often would furnish the sections in a kind of very colorful way. So we sent out a telex, we're looking for the best of the worst section, you know, furniture that you have in the section offices for this art show about Sandman's Place. And the deal was that if you give me this piece of furniture for the show, it'll never come back to you again. You'll never see it again. And I went around the city and I got the best of the worst. And there were some famous, they call them Mongo collections, like collections of great stuff. You know, now people will call them collectibles.
Right.
So it was really, I'll show an image of this Sandman's Place. That was just really, really, you know, if you look at it one way, it's like this sort of a kind of creativity to make the best of a situation and pick the best of the crummiest stuff that you see. But I had two sections. One was made out of stuff that every single thing came out of a real section. Also, sanitation workers would save art. Like people would throw art out and they wouldn't put it in the truck. They would save it. They would literally save the art. They were art savers. And so that they would mount these paintings, you know, frame like salon style, like many, 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 many paintings. There were garages that had hundreds of paintings, hundreds.
Right.
Like beautiful assemblages. And next to it, this was at the Ronald Feldman Gallery in Soho. I had the first time in New York City history that sanitation got its own furniture.
Mara Lederman-Euclides is an artist, and she will be giving a lecture tonight, the 10th of May, at 6 o'clock at Tipton Hall. That's on the campus of the College of Santa Fe, sponsored by the Santa Fe Art Institute. It's been wonderful hearing your stories, and we look forward to seeing you tonight.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to .foil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.